This is Sea Change Radio, covering the shift to sustainability. I'm Alex Wise.
I find that being able to draw an emotion allows you to kind of connect with the emotional state that you're at the time. And teaching cartoons and teaching it through emotion allows me to kind of work with these kids and talk to these kids about their own personal feelings and about expressing their feelings.
The list of things for which San Francisco is famous include iconic bridges, world-class pride celebrations, excellent food, and murals. The streets of San Francisco are a veritable outdoor gallery with classics from Diego Rivera, artistic achievements lining modest alleys like Balmy and Albion, and dozens of works by today's guest on Sea Change Radio. This week we're speaking with San Francisco artist and muralist extraordinaire Saran Norris about his life's work. We hear about the road he took to become a painter, the greatest challenges a muralist faces, and the delicate balance of creating art that both enhances and is integrated into its surroundings.
Well, I look at stars.
I'm joined now on Sea Change Radio by Saran Norris. He is an artist and a San Francisco legend. Saran, welcome to Sea Change Radio.
Thank you for having me.
Most people know your art through the murals that you paint around the Bay Area. Why don't you explain your mission as an artist who works with public spaces?
I think everybody has their reason for doing murals. And yes, it is probably part of how I make a living. But I also feel like, and I hope what I bring to San Francisco is I take it as an honor. And I take it as a little bit of a responsibility to be a muralist and to put art out there that has reach. I've always felt like storytelling is really important. It's a lost art form. And I think like the power of murals is to be able to tell a story without words to anyone from that speaks any language from anywhere and be able to tell them a story, tell them a story about a period of time, tell them a story about someone. And with cartoons, it allows me to tell stories that are dramatic and that talk about death and that are dark because I cloak it with the cartoon. And so I take a responsibility that, you know, everybody walks by wherever I paint every day and they're going to see that and they're going to get brainwashed. And so you either take that as a responsibility to fulfill these people and fulfill these minds of these people with something positive or, you know, be selfish with it. And just do something, you know, that looks good on Instagram.
Speaking of trying to tell a story, why don't we take a step back and tell us your story a little bit and how you came to be a full-time artist and how you, and maybe give us a little bit more of a background into your introduction into the art form of murals.
Well, I was in Ohio. I was like 23 years old. And I had finished school and I was just kind of floundering and I just packed up everything I had in my car and I drove across the United States and I didn't really have that much money. I might've had like $600 and I just packed up everything I had. And then I moved to San Francisco.
What year is this?
This was 1997. And so I just had a car, those hills and everything. I was just like, I was like, I have to get out of the city. This is not a place where I can post up in my car. And I ended up going to this hotel right off the Bay Bridge, kind of like in Emeryville. And I posted up in their parking lot for like a week until I got a job at this copy station. Just like, you know, sending my resume from like using the hotel fax machine. I got a job at this print station, which was at the BART station. And I just started working. And I had some relatives. I had some relatives that let me stay with them. And I eventually got an internship 6 months later. And it was a free internship at a software development company making video games, specifically like children's educational video games using like licenses. They didn't pay me But I wanted to get published. I was, you know, this was a job where you could make art, but I had to stick it out for like 6 months for free as an intern before I could get a salary. And 6 months later, I got hired. Hired at the video game company. You know, they gave me salary. They gave me like $30,000 a year. And I think like that's really what started my thing with cartoons, because I was always a cartoonist. I always loved it, but I never took it seriously because I felt like that just wasn't really a thing that was all that respected. I was more of an illustrator. I felt like illustration was, but you know, was respected. But cartoons were always my thing.
When you say always, like as a, you've always drawn?
I've always drawn. I've always been an artist. I always knew I was going to be an artist my whole entire life. You know, I went to school for it, and my dream was to be a professional artist, not what I am now, where I, you know, I'm an independent artist or whatever. My dream was to like work for someone and get published and do all that. So, you know, making video games was on track. I was immersed in technology. I knew technology anyways. It just immersed me into really figuring out the pathology of a cartoon, how people perceive cartoons, how cartoons were created over time in terms of like the style, the concept of asymmetrical eyes and eye placement, all this stuff like I was really immersed in and had to be very self-aware of, and found that that was probably the one thing that I felt artistically came to me the easiest. Replicating someone's style, anything that had to do with a cartoon, I was on it.
But you weren't creating your own. You hadn't really found your own voice.
So after that first year, I felt like, you know, I definitely had an art director, and being art directed showed me to myself. I felt like I knew better than my art director. And my art director was always giving me these things where it was too much, too intense. And I was like, no, I know what's better. I know what's right. And what that told me was like, I have so much more to do. And so through that experience showed me how I really needed to be my own artist. And so I was like, well, I just got finished basically working two jobs for the last year. One of them didn't pay me. And so I'm going to do this again. I'm going to work two jobs. One of them's not going to pay me. And this second job is going to be me making paintings every night when I come home. And so every night when I'd come home, I'd make paintings. I made like four of them over probably a six-month time. And I took pictures of them and published the pictures. They were 4x6 pictures of these four pieces. And my skateboard broke down, and I was riding my skateboard down Market Street. My skateboard broke down, and I went to this DLX, a skate shop. I don't know if it's still there, probably. And I was getting my wheel fixed, and this artist was like, yeah, there's like this open call at this gallery down the street. It's called the Luggage Store. And I had these photos on me, and I was like, I'm just going to roll down there and check this gallery out. So I rolled down there. And Lori was there, who runs it. And at the time, you know, I didn't know anything about the Luggage Store. I didn't know anything about the art scene, nothing. And she, you know, asked me who I was. And I was looking around, and it was kind of, you know, highbrow art and art that was, you know, kind of graffiti related. That was the time, the moment, you know, we're talking about. At this time, we're probably talking about 1998, right?
So like the height of Banksy.
Yeah. Banksy's not till like maybe 2003 on. This was like the moment where they took graffiti and they moved it to the gallery. They tried to uplift it. It was an elevation of the can. That was the moment. That was like really what was kind of in vogue at the time. And really kind of trying to take urban style and transitioning it to make a lot of money out of it. And a lot of people who did graffiti who didn't have a highly illegal past were able to transition to that gallery. I was not on that wavelength because it's not what I did. I grew up in Ohio. I grew up in the suburbs. I never touched a can ever in my life. That wasn't my thing, but I was Black. And I think that that did help me at the time for people to be like, oh, that's what they were looking for. Like it fit along with what people were looking for. And my work fit within this slot that wasn't graffiti. It wasn't cartoons. It wasn't like illustration. It fit with all that. It evoked all of it. It hit its own little spot, but it it opened people's eyes to everything that they were familiar with, but it was not something they had ever seen before. It just touched everything that they had known. And so they saw it, and instantly, boom, that woman was like, when at the luggage store, Lori, she was like, got a show. It was a group show, but she gave it to me. And it was like maybe in like 3 or 4 months. It was pretty soon. Tons of people were in that show, and it was a group show. And my work. And it was my first show. It was the canvases had staples on the side. Like, I didn't know what I was doing. But I got to meet everybody, and I didn't sell anything at that show. But what I did get is I got an artist in residence at the De Young Museum. So a curator at the De Young Museum was there.
Was at the luggage store.
Was at the luggage store on the day of that show. It was very fortuitous. The thing, though, was it was at the De Young. Now, if you say the De Young right now, people are like, wow. But the De Young in 1998, 1999 was not wow. And it wasn't really respected. It was pretty and all that. And it was right in Golden Gate Park in the same location that it's at now. But it didn't have the gusto. It didn't have the attendance, none of that. And so they had this concept where they wanted to create this artist at work program where they gave you a studio and you work there, and you know that was your artist in residence.
Did people come watch you do it?
And people come watch you paint, and they pay you.
Like you were making pizzas.
Yeah, but you can paint work that you can sell at another time, right? And you still get like a stipend. And so they wanted to bring in, you know, for me to bring in this younger, because they did have an artist in residence at the time too. And this blows my mind now. So the artist in residence at that time was Ruth Asawa, who I don't know if you know who she is.
Oh, definitely. But I don't know if our national audience knows. So
yeah, Ruth Asawa. I mean, you know, it trips me out right now just because, like, at this moment, she's about to have this show at SF MoMA. So you could go by any bus station. You'll have buses that'll pass you, and it'll just be Ruth Asawa and her work.
I hear great things about it. It's already open.
Yeah, all right. Yeah, yeah, yeah. I mean, you know, it's and the De Young has always, like, even the De Young Contemporary Times has always just been a huge, you know, supporter of her work. But I feel like, and of course, you know, they named the School of Arts after her. But of course, none of this happened until she passed away.
For the streets of Rome are filled with rubble. Aged footprints are everywhere. You can almost think that you're seeing double on a cold, dark night on the Spanish stairs. Got to hurry on back to my hotel room, where I've got me a date with Botticelli's niece. Yup, she promised that she'd be right there with me when I paint my masterpiece.
This is Alex Wise on Sea Change Radio, and I'm speaking to artist Saran Norris. So, Saran, we were talking about Ruth Asawa, who's a legendary artist and art instructor. And beyond your murals, you also do a lot of educational art. And Ruth was well known for doing that. I know she came into my wife's grade school as a traveling independent artist who would educate. Yeah. She grew up in San Francisco, so Ruth was very much part of that artistic education for a lot of young San Franciscos of my wife's generation. Now you've kind of taken that mantle and are doing that as well. Why don't you explain what you do for San Francisco Public Unified School District and other schools, and how you try to educate kids about and turn them on to art?
I always say I can teach. I'm a really good teacher, but I'm not a teacher. That is a particular kind of person that I am not. That's a person that I have so much respect for. I teach. I can teach, and I love to do it, but I do it for a purpose, and I only can do it for a limited amount of time. So I'm very strategic.
So explain what an engagement might look like from a school when they have you come in. How does that usually work?
Yeah, I mean, you know, I run my own business, so I have my own studio and gallery at the studio on 24th Street. At the studio, I run after school classes and I also run summer camps. All that stuff is paid. All that stuff is for profit. What I try to do and what I've always tried to do is I've tried to create scholarships for the classes that I have at the studio, but also try to travel to schools and be able to kind of give 1 or 2 hours to that school teaching just basic cartoons. And so San Francisco Unified, in particular, Dolores Forta, which used to be Fairmount Elementary.
Where my daughter went.
Where your daughter went. Yes, I taught your daughter. I've taught so many kids. It's remarkable. I was at a high school graduation or high school prom getting ready thing, and I met all these kids that that I taught that are now about to go to college, which blows my mind. But I've taught at that particular school for, I'd say, 13 years, maybe. Teaching generations of kids at that, teaching brothers and sisters, and, you know, kids prepare for it getting into the third grade, that this is actually going to be something that's going to happen for them in the third grade. And it's been part of that school forever. And that school has created interns for me that are now my full employees that, you know, I taught at Dolores Forta when they were, you know, 8 years old, that now work for me, that are now, you know, yes, about to graduate from high school.
So what are you teaching them different than their day-to-day art class? And how are you infusing your values and your medium into their artistic endeavors?
I teach cartoons. So the bar is very low. And the thing with cartoons versus just saying, hey, I'm going to teach art, is I can just kind of hide these concepts of perspective and foreground and background and portrait and landscape and all these different artistic terms. I can just like input them within the context of cartoon lessons. But any kid, no matter what, just like soccer and skateboarding, they're all going to try it once. And cartoons is something where no matter what kind of, you know, artistic talent you have, you more than likely will be interested in, can it participate in it. And usually the majority of the kids try it out. And I teach it in a way where I slowly build on these lessons. I teach it in a way where we focus on expression. All the lessons go through expression, because I find that being able to draw an emotion allows you to kind of connect with the emotional state that you're at the time. And teaching cartoons and teaching it through emotion allows me to kind of work with these kids and talk to these kids about their own personal feelings and about expressing their feelings. Because in the end, if I teach a kid that day two expressions through cartoons, that kid at the end of that hour lesson can tell a story, because he can now draw one expression to another character with another expression. And that's a story. So no matter what I'm trying to do, it always kind of comes around to being able to tell a story or to be able to give these kids another language.
And when did you come up with your trademark Blue Bear? I'd be curious of the genesis of that character.
That's funny, actually. I just did a thing with KQED, because I did all their merchandise for their pledge drive about the Blue Bear.
Does the Blue Bear have a name?
No, it's just the Blue Bear, just like Pink Panther. He's been around for so long. The first one was probably in 1999 at the corner of Valencia and 17th. And the only reason why that bear was blue at the time was I was working on cartoon literalism, which is my art form, because at the time, back in the day...
Wait, can you define that? What does that mean?
Yeah, you know, I was showing in museums. You know, I was at... I was in museums. I was at the De Young. I was getting artists in residence. I eventually got one at Yerba Buena Center. And during that time when I was immersed in the fine art world, which I am definitely not anymore, and I can elaborate on that later, but when I was, I felt like I didn't want to be one of those artists where the art was crap, but like there was a really strong story that elevated the art to another level because the story was so strong. You know, so I came up with cartoon literalism, which basically is this concept of where, and basically the genesis of my first four pieces that I got basically started my career. And that was this idea of I would just create a diary of my life and I would put it on the canvas of what's happening with me at this very moment. And what I do is I would break it all down to specific cartoon characters that were the most cliche cartoon characters that we've all grown up with. So there's a series of cartoon characters that we're familiar with in terms of animals, right? Tons of dogs, tons of bears. We could say tons of dogs, tons of bears, tons of cats, tons of rabbits. All cartoon television shows have one of those four or five animals. These are cartoon cliches. And so what I did was I took these cartoon cliches and basically attached metaphors, words, basically, to each one of these animals. So each time you see these animals interacting with each other and you know the definition of each one of these animals, then you basically can tell what's going on in my life at the time by just looking at the piece. So dogs were meant relaxation. Cats meant ultimate desire. Bears meant love, and rabbits meant sex. And so back in the day, whenever you were able to see any of my pieces, you were able to look at the bear and see the state the bear is in. You'd be able to look at the rabbit and see the state the rabbit was in, what it was doing, blah, 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 etc. And you'd be able to tell exactly what was going on in my life. And so when people saw my pieces back in the day, it was like all these animals and they're all anamorphosized and they're all going inside each other and there's all this crazy stuff going on and they're all communicating with all this emotion, boom, boom, boom. And that started it. And the bear was love. The bear was always the metaphor for love because of the duality of a bear. Bears can be perceived as like grizzly bears, super scary, awful, or teddy bears, cute, cuddly, safe. And so just like love, you know, it's got that duality where it can be really bad or it can be like really beautiful and cuddly. And so at the time, you know, and still wasn't in a relationship. And so my love was blue. It was negative, you know. And so that's how the big blue bear came about. When I was once married and engaged, I was painting a mural. And that's Victorian, which is on Balmy Alley. And that was in 2007. And that has brown bears.
I'm going. Move up to the chaos, baby. I'm gonna paint my mailbox blue. I'm gonna move up to the chaos, baby. Yes, I'm gonna paint my mailbox blue. I'm gonna put some flowers on it, mama. Yes, paint some trailing vines.
This is Alex Wise on Sea Change Radio, and I'm speaking to Saran Norris. He's an artist, muralist, and educator.
So what's the biggest hurdle you have to face logistically in terms of making murals?
Avoiding getting tagged.
What does that mean exactly?
Getting vandalized.
That's one of the fears of a muralist, is some other artist or tagger is going to deface your work.
That's the biggest fear of a muralist. That's wow. That's the only fear of a muralist.
I hadn't considered that.
Oh, it's one of the biggest problems, yeah.
Are any of these taggers artists on their own, or are they purely just... Have you ever met anybody who's tagged murals? Like, I'm curious.
Oh God, yes.
where their thought process is coming in terms of ruining something like that.
You know... There used to be a time back in the day when there were OG mentors in the tagging community that I would have assumed would be able to kind of like help legislate where tagging should be and should not be, and the respect that a tag on a mural and, you know, the work that's involved, like what comes down to somebody doing that. What the result is. I think those people that were guiding those kids and having them grow up with this guidance, and then, you know, generation upon generation, I don't think those people are here anymore. I think they probably got all gentrified out. And so now we have generations of kids that have grown up only seeing tagging like they see skateboarding. It's a rite of passage.
As an artist, how much of what you do should be integrated into its environment? That kind of balance between creating a new environment versus integrating into the existing environment. When you were talking about the iterative process with the Glen Park community, I can imagine there's a lot of different voices on both sides. One that wants like a much bolder visual versus one that wants something a little more decorative, right? You have these polar opposite voices talking to you at the same time. It must be a really difficult tightrope to walk.
You have to find your own way and your own style and your own way of communicating. I mean, you know, I had the biggest hurdle to jump where I'm a muralist. I am not Latino. I am in the Mission District, which is all Latino. All murals in the Mission District are all, or the majority of them, and especially when I started back in the day, were all, you know, Latino-based images, Latino-based stories. And I was able to say, okay, I'm going to create murals here. I want to honor what's going on here because I totally 100% respect it. But at the same time, I have to be me and I can't be weighed down and forced to kind of like weave my way and you know, assimilate to the style. Because if I don't, people are going to mess with my murals. And, you know, I think like the power and specifically in the Mission District, it's interesting because those murals that are in the Mission District that are so powerful, that talk about these Latino stories, that have these really great narratives that are almost impenetrable because they have these Latino narratives on these Latino images on them, they become almost like a church where no one would tag that. No one would mess with that area because it has value. Because it glorifies and uplifts and explains what's going on in that community. It creates value. That being said, I was like, wow, you know, I have to honor the idea of at least creating something that has value. Because if you have something that has value to the community and the people surrounding, it will be protected. It'll also be appreciated. So I had to learn how to create something outside of Latino trope and create something that still got respect in the Mission District, that still talked about the trials and tribulations in the Mission District, still talked about serious things, but through my vision. And so it took me a long time to figure that out.
Saran Norris, thanks so much for being my guest on Sea Change Radio.
My absolute pleasure. It was fun. Thank you for your great questions.
Sway the future to the past and find what will endure.
You've been listening to Sea Change Radio. Our intro music is by Sanford Lewis, and our outro music is by Alex Wise.
Additional music by Thievery Corporation, Bob Dylan, and Taj Mahal.
Check out our website at seachangeradio.com. That's seachangeradio.com to stream or download the show or subscribe to our podcast. Visit our archives there to hear from Bill McKibben, Van Jones, Paul Hawken, and many others. And tune in to Sea Change Radio next week as we continue making connections for sustainability. For Sea Change Radio, I'm Alex Wise.